The work of this church in the world is realized through the generous financial support of all who call this place home. Along with the gifts and time and talent, ours is a shared ministry. You have a role to play here. Church membership is open to all. For more information, go to uusf.org.
I love the way the birds sing louder when the music is playing, like they're in conversation with us in here. Jacqueline Woodson, a famous writer for, among other things, her National Book Award-winning memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, writes, "The more specific we are, the more universal something can become. Life is in the details. If you generalize, it doesn't resonate. The specificity of it is what resonates." I think that's true, and I think it holds for what we love, love enough to work for and sacrifice for. I don't think you and I fall in love with the world in general, but the specifics, and then our love grows out from there. So, thinking about Earth Day, I got to thinking about how we have to save the world, but we don't save the world because we fall in love with the abstract world, or we don't start there. We start with the small things we fall in love with in the world, some of the ones we named this morning. So we could start anywhere to remember why we want to save it all. So how about the elephant? In some ways, elephants are unlikely creatures to fall in love with. Their skin is thick and hard. If you've ever touched them, they have these wiry hairs that come out of it. They're strangely put together creatures. I mean, at least from my perspective, maybe they think that of us. Sometimes looks like some of the creatures in the universe, God had some bits laying around and stuck them together and was like, that'll do. The elephant sometimes looks to me like one of those. I always liked them, but I think I started to fall in love with elephants, really fell on a 3-month trip through Southeast Asia, when at the time I was in the jungles of northern Thailand and watched an elephant stop mid-stride and reach down into the jungle and pull out from between the grasses a small piece of carved wood in its trunk and hand it up to its mahout, the handler, the driver who sat on the back of his head. Well, mahout took the wood that was handed to him, or trunked to him, I guess you could say, looked at it, and tossed it back into the jungle. The elephant stood still for a moment, refusing to move, and then slowly lumbered forward as if not understanding the stupidity of his mount, and reached around to where it had been thrown and found it again and gave it again to the man on his head. At this point, I think the driver, knowing his stubborn match, tucked the wood into his pocket, eager to get moving. The piece of wood I was able to see from where I stood was one of the pieces that went between a bar on the saddle that sat on the elephant's, a platform that had a bar attached so that its rider had something to bounce up against and held those two bits together. It wasn't the one that matched his saddle, but it was one of those. It gave me a window, just a peek into this big, lumbering, enduring, but intelligent, nuanced, relational, determined creature. And everything I've learned since has made me love them more. Especially Vicky Constantine Croak's book, Elephant Company, which I cannot recommend highly enough. It's part natural history, it's part human-animal love story, it's part heroic war story, it's all wrapped into one, and it's so readable. And it begins as a book about a company of elephants in Burma, and one man who's in charge of a group of them, this Welshman, James Howard Williams, a man his friends call Billy. Williams, as the backstory, had survived 4 years of brutal service in the British Army, in what was then called the Great War, soon to be called World War I. He'd seen battle on four fronts, from Egypt, where he served in the Camel Corps, to fighting on the mountainous border terrain into Afghanistan. It was all brutal. It was a war that left many of his contemporaries dead and many others maimed, physically or emotionally. Williams arrived home miraculously physically intact, but refusing to talk about what had happened to him in the war, and clear about what would be healing to him was time alone in the jungles of Burma with elephants, something someone he had met in his journeys in the war had said was possible if you worked for the Burma Teak Company. This choice wasn't a total surprise for those who knew Williams. He was a Welshman who had a love for the natural world. It started as a child. He grew up near and wandering every day for hours the moors that were close to his home, all seasons of the years. He would watch the world around him, he would write, till he could predict where the animals would go and where they would build their nests, find them without ever having seen one by reaching into a bush, knowing that that would be the perfect place for a given bird, until he could unravel all the secrets of the mysterious natural world at his feet. And so, despite his father's attempt to buy him some land near the family farm to keep the young man home, Williams was hired by the Burma Teak Company and eventually made his way to the jungles of Upper Burma, where he was given oversight on some of the company's most precious resources. Its most precious resource, its elephants. It was 1920, and Burma was under British rule, and it produced, well, the British extracted from Burma 75% of the world's teak, a wood that many of you may know is impervious to insects and has an oil that's part of it too that makes it protective against corrosion, metal corrosion. So it was a beloved, beautiful wood that was also loved by boat builders, the British Navy, among others. But there were no roads to get into these jungles where the huge teak trees grew. It was the elephants that made the harvest of teak possible. Elephants who could get through the forests, felling branches and trees and small brush on the way, and drag the felled trees, the ones they helped fell, to the dry riverbeds during the non-monsoon part of the season. And then when the rains would come, they would lift those logs and float them downstream to merge with other tributaries where people would meet and tie them together into huge rafts, and eventually they'd make their way to European and other markets. But without the elephants, there was no Burma Teak Company. Williams's job was threefold, he was told: to supervise and pay the men who worked in the camps, to tend to the medical needs of the elephants, and to make sure production was keeping pace. To do this, he would move between the various camps, checking in and tending to the needs and issues that arose. And to prepare, he read everything that was available, which wasn't a lot, but everything he could about elephant medicine, and started to get to know the animals. This was the part he loved more than most who did his job, and he was good at it. Immediately, it was clear as he inspected each animal, learning to touch its whole body, that they were as interested in him as he was in them. As he traced their bodies, their trunks would roam around his body. And he already knew from his life in nature that different animals had different personalities, and so he started to learn theirs, the gentle ones, the playful ones, the stubborn ones. He memorized their bodies, the scars, the telltale signs of aging in the bends and tears in their ears, the relationships. Some companies had parents and children working side by side, but in others there were mothers who bonded together, though unrelated, to raise their calves like a chosen family of aunties. Each day, the elephants would work for 8 hours from morning until late afternoon. And the next 16 hours, he discovered they were set free to roam the nearby jungle. Bells hung around their necks so they could be found by their keepers the next morning. Setting them free was an easy way to keep them fed, is the truth of it. Easier than harvesting the feed, because hard-working logging elephants could eat 600 pounds of fodder a day. They would grab most of it with their trunks, putting it in their mouth. The trunk, this multi-use appendage, a nose that is 5 times more sensitive to smell than a bloodhound's nose, an appendage of 60,000 muscles, and the trunk also an organ to modulate the sound of the elephant's voice, it turns out. Much of an elephant's communication is actually infrasound, a sound whose frequency is so low that it doesn't register to human ears. But communication that can reach as far as 5 miles, apparently. Infrasound, however, was something that Williams could feel the first time he met them, the first time he was among the elephants. This odd sense he had that the air around him was vibrating. It wouldn't be until the 1980s that scientists would confirm what Williams and the elephant keepers suspected, that communication was going on between the elephants in this vibration they felt in the air. And there are so many stories of Williams and the elephants, how he followed them into the jungle at night, despite everybody's warnings about what was there, tigers, dangerous wildlife of all kinds that waited, how he would see when he watched them what they were capable of. It wasn't unusual, for instance, for elephants at night to find their way to some cultivated patch, a banana field or other farm whose bounty looked pretty beautiful, but knowing that their bells would give them away to the farmers as the farmers slept, the elephants would scoop up in their trunks thick mud and stuff it into the clapper of the bells. And then a night of gorging and a destroyed harvest would ensue. They were brilliant, they were clever, they were rational. There's a story he had of an elephant that he had treated for months for horrible festered wounds, trotting one day into the camp right up to him where he sat drinking his cup of tea and then sitting down right in front of him. He had no idea what she meant to communicate, so he patted her, and the mahout, the handler, came and asked her to get up, and she trotted away. But later, when it was the time for the formal inspection of the animals and the careful running of his hands, he found, as he ran his hand over her back, a warm place slightly raised under her skin, and then when he looked, a small opening showing signs of an infection. Perhaps the reason that she, who had learned to trust him, came immediately to show him her back, where she sensed this festering wound and wanted it cared for. There are beautiful stories and heartbreaking stories, like the mature female elephant who in the night in the jungle accidentally brushes against a plant, one that releases this kind of caustic substance. Except that she, in some panicked run from a threat, had the ill luck for it to brush against her face and cornea and is blinded. Her son stays with her, begins without instruction to walk ahead of her every day, close enough that she can wrap her trunk around his tail, so she can continue working and making her way to the jungle with him to feed at night and to stay with the pack and to survive. But maybe the most dramatic stories, I mean, there are many, is how Bandula and Williams bond the moment they meet this extraordinary, majestic elephant that everyone wants to claim a relationship to. He and Williams have this bond. It turns out Bandula's been raised by a handler who early on sees this extraordinary little baby elephant who does all the commands that are given to his mother without being taught any of them and sees the intelligence, but also that this elephant needs to be handled not in some of the brutal ways that animals were broken to serve the teak company and industry. So treats this animal with kindness and rewards, and it would change the way other elephants were trained, but it also maybe opened space for this elephant to be in the world a little differently. There's the story of Williams growing sick in the jungle, dangerously sick, as so many people did who went from Britain to work there. Even the man who wrote one of the classic books on elephant medicine died in Burma from fever. And how Bandula seems to sense that Williams is sick, maybe from the smell, maybe from the way he is moving slow and bent over. And how it's monsoon, when they normally wouldn't travel. A season when an elephant's leg would go 3 feet down into the mud. And the energy it took then with each step to pull, suction the leg out. How exhausting it was, so why they stayed in camp, but how Bandula allowed them to put Williams on his back and went days without balking or resisting. Through this monsoon jungle, a trip that included fording a river where the waters were as high as this enormous elephant's back, where each foot had to slowly move forward, not to lose its footing and be carried down the river, taking blows from tree logs that raged down the river like missiles, and got Williams to care so that he survived. And how the two would go on to work together and face World War II together and become war heroes together. I've learned more about life from elephants than I ever did from human beings, Williams would say later in life. Courage, loyalty, the ability to trust, and the good sense to know when to be distrustful. Fairness, patience, kindness, humor, not a bad way to learn, he said, because the elephant takes a more kindly view of life than we do. Williams would say how he learned the difference between being a bully and a leader from elephants, how to woo a mate, which, in case you're wondering, is stay close, watch them, be respectful, and wait for the invitation to come closer. How he learned all of this from observing and being in relationship to these animals he cared for, who cared for him, who helped him heal from one war and accompanied him through another. Edgar Villanueva, Jesus, Martin Buber, and wise people through time have said that the myth of separateness is one of the most tragic errors, human beings, that we have fallen error to through time. Separateness as that thing that makes us treat other living creatures as a thing, from circus animals to refugees to the whole web of life, to exploit and extract, as if all of life are just resources for our use, including other human beings. All of this out of this myth of separateness, disconnection. I'm pretty sure that the healing from this starts then with connection and the cultivation of that again in us. In rituals like we did today, to name what we love and feel connected to and even grieve for, to make space for what it means to love people and places and the wide expanse of life outside ourselves and all it makes us vulnerable to start wherever we can, the elephant, the garden, the places we grew up in with their fauna and landscape. But from there, wherever that is, to find the strength and devotion to lift the sick earth feverish onto our backs and head out into the raging monsoon rivers and mud to walk her, to walk us all back toward healing. Because all we love depends on that. So may the spirit of Bondaloo and all that is gorgeous and all that is fierce and all that is connected in this world go with us. Amen.
I just remembered this morning how to make an elephant out of a balloon. Somebody told me it looks like a dog with a long nose, but there's that guy. I stood right up here one fine Sunday and proclaimed, "Damn everything but the circus." E.E. Cummings said that, and I agreed with the sentiment, though I've always had some reservations. Not anymore. The so-called greatest show on earth is no more. Kaput. No more aerialists swinging through the air with the greatest of ease. No more magicians doing magic tricks, nor showgirls, nor clowns to send in. Cotton candy, candied apples, giant pretzels, all vanished. And especially no more tamed wild animals. No lions, nor tigers, no bears. Oh my. And especially no humongous gray pachyderms, which is just fine with me. It is my contention that these great animals were never treated humanely or fairly. And that was in no small part responsible for the death of the circus as we know it. Jumbo the elephant, one of P.T. Barnum's star attractions, was not treated kindly. He was an 11-foot, 6-ton animal, and he was tragically killed by a runaway train in Ontario in 1895. They say perhaps his trainer was intoxicated. Worse, perhaps Jumbo himself was intoxicated, as it was common practice to give the giant spirits to calm him down. After Jumbo's death, Barnum had him stuffed and put on display in one of his museums for 25 cents a piece to see him. Jumbo had a difficult life, but nothing compared to Topsy. Topsy was a 28-year-old elephant who had killed a spectator the year before and been sentenced to death. So in 1903, Thomas Edison purchased Topsy for the express purpose of electrocuting the poor beast. You see, Edison was for his invention of direct current and claimed that Tesla and Westinghouse's alternating current was unsafe, even deadly. He made a 1-minute silent film that his company called Electrocuting an Elephant. But what they actually did to her is so cruel and unspeakable that Vanessa would not let me say it from the pulpit, not in worship, not without a trigger warning, not with one, though you can look it up if you like to look human cruelty straight in the eye. Perhaps the most bizarre elephant mistreatment I researched was that of Tusco the elephant, a resident of the Oklahoma City Zoo. He'd been brought in from Arizona to be a mate for Judy the elephant. However, Judy tired of his advances and slammed Tusco into a wall one day, knocking off one of his tusks. Tusco was not discouraged by this and actually seemed even more enamored by Judy's attention. Along comes a prominent psychiatrist and author named Dr. West, who in an attempt to induce a condition in bull elephants known as must, artificially administers 297 milligrams of LSD to Tusco. Tusco immediately fell over and had seizures. The scientists quickly administered an anti-seizure drug and the seizures stopped, but Tusco died of the overdose. LSD was not yet illegal, and nor had it become popularized. Ken Kesey's Merry Prankster bus ride was still 5 years away from happening, and poor Tusco suffered for our ignorance. It may seem odd to you that a professional clown like me would be against the circus, but mistreatment there of all kinds of exotic animals has always made my blood boil. One commonly used tool on the elephants was the bull hook, a long pole with a sharp hook on it. designed to achieve obedience. In 2016, Governor Jerry Brown, whose mother went to this church, signed a ban on bullhooks in California, so there is some progress. Now I find my heart more firmly aligned with non-animal circuses, such as Cirque du Soleil, the Canadian entertainment company, who are the largest producers of modern-day circuses in the world. Change in this world is wonderful and certainly appreciated, and they are committed to not ever using animals in their acts.